book I'm going to give away one of these Sundays. Dan, the Pioneer of Israel, by Colonel J.C. Galler. The tribe of Dan, by its enterprise and vigor, has made itself one of the most conspicuous branches of Jacob's family. Its ancestor was the son of one of the concubines and was the firstborn of Rachel's household. "God hath judged me," said Rachel, and called his name Dan, which means judge or rule. This word, perhaps on that occasion, first started as a surname, had been perpetuated as a title in the Gothic, Anglo-Saxon, and English. In these languages, Din, Dun, Don, Dan signify ruler, master, and there's no vowel in the original language, only consonants. So you'd have to be there and hear it when first used to know whether it was properly pronounced Din, Dun, Don, or Dan. Expressions repeatedly used by Shakespeare, Spenser, Chaucer, Prior, and others. The Spanish, too. From close contact for ages with the Hebrews has engrafted it in their title of Don. It is in use in our universities to designate a professor or university official, a high official. At a conference in Bayswater, long ago, 1875, a speaker took exception to such statements about the word Dan. He believed that the university in Spanish Don was derived from the Latin Dominus, or Dominus. And as for Dun in Scotch, it meant a hill. The objector seemed not to know how thoroughly he was confirming what had been asserted. He didn't seem to reflect that Rome, who was not even an infant in arms when Rachel said, "God hath judged me," must have coined her Dominus and Damno from the Hebrew or Phoenician. And as regards Dun, Don likewise in the Gothic means hill, as well as master, and in this double signification they merely resemble the word eminence, which in Ireland especially is used as a title. Dun or Don, therefore, being identical. How come they to mean a hill and yet often to be the name of a river? Unless it be for the same reason that another form of the name was once also imposed on a town. The tribe of Dan conquered a town and named it, changed its name, abandoned the old name, and renamed it Dan after their father. Judges 18:29. How often am I boring you? Now, you're going to have to go back to juggling many things at once again. I'm laying foundations for going back and going through Genesis verse by verse. And then I keep coming back to Jeremiah. I'm going to do that tonight. How often do we see in the Bible that the name of an individual foreshadows the character and career, thus being prophetic? Dan's name, given by Rachel, implies authority and vigor, and Jacob, when bestowing his blessings, Genesis 49:16, repeats and confirms it, saying, "Dan shall judge his people," and proceeded to name other characteristics, leaving a serpent's trail. And after such a blessing on Dan, we raised this question the other night. All of a sudden, Jacob exclaimed, "I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord." Now, he must have seen something not immediately obvious in the name Dan. What was in the patriarch's mind? Did a vision of Dan's future career pass in review before him? And he blurted out, I've waited for thy salvation, O Lord. Did he see the pioneers of Israel by land and sea, which was Dan, carrying on their enterprise and explorations, trading among the Grecian islands into the Black Sea, up the various rivers, crossing Asia Minor, exploring Europe, scouring the Mediterranean, on to the broad Atlantic, meeting the overland parties at the Baltic, settling in Denmark, and making a secret, secure little hiding place and sanctuary for centuries in Ireland and other settlements in England and Scotland? Well, he couldn't see that. That would take a miracle. That might make you believe in God. And did the patriarch still see this tribe in the van leading back to the land of promise? To take up their first place, the most northerly, in the day when the Lord shall beat off from the channel of the river of Egypt, and that day when the Lord shall bind up the breach of his people and heal the stroke of their wound? No, he couldn't see that. That'd take a miracle. Miracle. Shortly after the Israelites left Egypt, the tribe of Dan numbered of fighting men alone, from 20 years old and upwards, all that were able to go forth to war, 62,700. They were declared such in Numbers chapter 1. And their very lot that fell to them in the promised land was calculated to stir up the inherent spirit. Their lot was the coast from Ashkelon to Joppa. Now, when you add up 62,700 fighting men plus wives and those under 20, I mean, 62,700 fighting men most likely had one kid each, at least. More probably with the divine imperative weighing down on them. Most probably 5 to 10 to 20. Being descended directly from a union between their father and a concubine, they weren't limited to one baggage carrier. So 62,700 fighting men, there were probably at least that many, maybe 5 times that many, under 20. And don't forget the ladies, necessary to carry out the divine imperative. Plus a lot of those that were too old to fight. They're not qualifying as fighting men. And fighting men had to be associated with others who didn't fight. Armor bearers. There were a heap of people. 300,000 would not be any kind of 4-hour estimate. Now, God knows what he's doing. Why would he put this many people in an area that in his very plan, too little for them? For Joshua 19, 40 to 47 says, the land when Joshua laid out the lots was too little for them. Well, hell. You can demonstrate God's purposes with a bowl of Jell-O. Squeeze it, and it squirts. Now, if you are contained on the seacoast with not too much space, you're going to swim or get in a boat. Early on, Dan became seafaring. one of the complaints during the period when Deborah gave her prophetic song and called the 10,000 fighting men in groups to fight against the enemy in the plain of Megiddo, and Barak came charging down from Mount Tabor, one of the complaints was Dan abode in her ships. They'd rather sail than fight. You think God didn't know how to count? You think he squeezed him into that little territory without knowing that it would force them to become what they did become? Sure he did. He knew what he was doing. 600 of them with their families and baggage promptly marched off northward to the spurs of Hermon, conquered a corner of Bashan, and with a sort of esprit de corps and veneration for their ancestor, which marked the whole career of this tribe, they called the name of their new conquest Dan, after the name of Dan, their father. It bears the impress of their determination to assert themselves and to verify their name, to rule and to be masters. Dan had ships and got on board them when invasion threatened. Now, Israel had been for long intervals under the yoke of Jabin, king of Canaan, the king of Moab, the king of Mesopotamia, and of the Philistines. Dan must have... Oh, you're nice. Shortly after the Israelites, I'm reading from Dan, the pioneer of Israel, by Colonel J.C. Galler, and I'm moving up to Jeremiah. Shortly after the Israelites left Egypt, the tribe of Dan numbered of fighting men alone from 20 years old and upward, all that were able to go forth to war, 62,700. It's a fair estimate that more than 300,000 people were in the tribe by that figure of fighting men from 20 years old and upward. And their very lot that fell to them in the promised land was calculated to stir up the inherent spirit. They were like a serpent in the way to leave a trail. Their lot was on the coast of Ashkelon to Joppa. And it was in the purposes of God, quote, too little for them. That's why Joshua 19, where the lots are described, phrases it. It was too little for them. B.C. 1443. So in a very few years, in Judges 18, 600 of them, with their families and baggage marched off northward, conquered a corner of Bashan, and named the territory after their conquest Dan, after the name of Dan, their father. Much was probably done in the following years like that, but the scriptures were written with one object, and hence matter irrelevant to that object finds no place. Yet it came within the purpose of God to tell us that about B.C. 1285, in Judges 5:17, Dan had ships and got on board them when an invasion threatened. And as for many years previous to this, Israel had been for long intervals under the yoke of Jabin, king of Canaan, of the king of Moab, the king of Mesopotamia, and of the Philistines, Dan must have been paying some attention to nautical matters. And the love of enterprise and freedom had probably considerably reduced the numbers left behind, who, unable then to cope with their enemies, finally thought it more prudent to follow. Certain it is that the tribe of Dan, if not entirely, certainly almost entirely, disappeared from Palestine. In 1 Chronicles 4, 5, 6, which were written after the Babylonish captivity, Dan as well as Zebulun and Asher, three tribes, all coastal tribes, are omitted from the genealogies. Alford, in Revelation 7, quotes several writers in his commentary on Revelation 7 as believing that Dan had become as good as extinct. Grotius quotes a Jewish tradition that this tribe was early reduced to one family named Hus, which is known to have perished in the wars before the time of Ezra. Eldad, a Jewish writer in the 14th or 9th century, writing to the Spanish Jews, says that, quote, in Jeroboam's time, B.C. 975, the tribe of Dan, being unwilling to shed their brethren's blood, took a resolution of leaving their country. Whatever became of them, therefore, they disappeared from Palestine entirely. But that it was not an extinction, in spite of what those scholars said, we know from the fact that it is recorded in Ezekiel 48 that in the final division of the land, not yet taken place, to be done after the restoration of the temple, during the millennium period, when the fourth temple will be built, first one by Solomon, second recorded in Ezra and Nehemiah, third by the returned Jews to Israel that will be desecrated by Antichrist, the fourth temple will be built during the millennium, according to the specifications in Ezekiel's prophecy. In those restoration passages, the land is reallocated, and that Dan is not extinct is proven by the fact that that event yet to take place has Dan coming in for his share at the head of the list. You're not interested.
Yes, sir.
The Old Testament having put us in this position, and God has a way of doing that. One of my most godlike traits is dangling. The Old Testament having put us in this position gives us one clue where to look for the lost tribe of Dan, then leaves it. One clue. The New Testament, to my mind, furnishes another clue as to its whereabouts. At a later period, by omitting the tribe altogether from the ceiling of the 144,000. Yeah. Doody-do. The Old Testament clue is as follows. Guess one. The Old Testament clue is as follows. I will determine at this point whether it follows or not. Ezekiel may be the word of God, but I'm going to determine tonight whether it follows. No, you're going to determine whether it follows. Two out of three. One heads and one tails. I missed it. Right over here, Peter. Heads, we don't tell you. It's so much fun to write the rules of the game as you go. The Old Testament clue is as follows, and all of you can call and apologize in a minute for what you thought. Ezekiel 17, verses 17 to 19. Writing in B.C. 588. Against Tyre, a city of the Phoenicians, and pronouncing her doom, says. Now that's interesting. The Old Testament clue is as follows. Ezekiel 17, verses 17 to 19. The question is, can you find it before I finish? Writing B.C. 588 against Tyre. And pronouncing her doom, says. The Old Testament clue is as follows. Ezekiel 27. I think I misspoke. The Old Testament clue is as follows. Ezekiel 27. Verses 17 to 19, writing B.C. 588 against Tyre, and pronouncing her doom, says, quote, Judah and the land of Israel. Check up on this old fellow. Ezekiel 27, verses 17 to 19. You've already read it three times, haven't you? Judah and the land of Israel. Now, that's rather interesting. Not the Israelites themselves who were then in captivity, but such inhabitants as there were. The Israelites have already been carried into captivity under the Assyrian conquerors by 588 B.C. And Ezekiel is prophesying after they're already in captivity. Right? Judah and the land of Israel. That's after Israel's captivity and resettlement by the Assyrians. They were thy merchants. They traded in thy markets wheat of Pinneth and panig and honey and oil and balm. Damascus was thy merchant in the multitude of the wares of thy making, for the multitude of all riches, in the wine of Helbon and white wool. Dan also. That means that Dan wasn't in captivity. But Dan was not of the kingdom of Judah. Dan was given a little territory south of Judah. Judah was comprised of the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, correct?
Yes, sir.
Dan was of the ten tribes. And the so-called ten-tribe kingdom, the house of Israel, has already been carried and resettled south of the Caspian Sea and around Lake Van, east of Assyria, west and north of the Medes or modern Iran. Dan also and Jabin, going to and fro, occupied in thy affairs, bright iron, cassia, calamus were in thy market. Not much, but a clue. Almost set this book on fire. The Old Testament clue is as follows. Ezekiel 27, verses 17 to 19, just read. Writing against Tyre in B.C. 588 and pronouncing her doom, says, Judah and the land of Israel, among other things, were thy merchants, Dan also, and Javan, going to and fro, occupied thy affairs. Now here's Dan and Javan in concert, going to and fro from somewhere, occupying the fairs of Tyre, which were on the city of Tyre, as you recall, was on the border of the Lebanese coast, destroyed by Alexander the Great in later years. After many wars, they moved the city to an island offshore, and he fulfilled the prophecy that her land would be bare and they'd throw fish nets on the site thereof. Because to conquer the new city, he built a causeway to the island and scraped the site of ancient Tyre bare. You can stand on the hilltop where, above Haifa, Elijah's haunts and look to the north, and up the coast to Tyre. Now, going to and fro, long after the ten tribes have been carried, the house of Israel, the nation of Israel, has been carried into bondage by the Assyrians, Dan is occupying, in concert with Javan, the fairs of Tyre, as merchants going to and fro. Now, in three places in Daniel, where Alexander the Great, the prince of Egypt, or rather the prince of Greece, is distinctly indicated, and once in Zechariah, four different Old Testament sites, Javan, in the King James, is translated Greece. And it's an accurate translation. Josephus also, first of his books, chapter 6, mentions Javan as being Greece. Hence, Dan, in this Old Testament clue, is indicated as in company with Greece, trading with Tyre, after the ten-tribe kingdom's been carried into bondage and resettled east of Assyria. You ain't interested in this. The Danites and men of Tyre were naturally on very intimate terms. It was a very remarkable privilege to be accorded to a foreign nation, if foreign, to be allowed to help in building Solomon's temple. The Danites and people of Tyre intermarried. The cunning craftsman, especially sent by Hiram to superintend the work of the temple, was the son of a man of Tyre. His mother was of the daughters of Dan, according to 2 Chronicles 2:14. And nobody knows who the Phoenicians are. They're sea people that write a certain way. By the time the Phoenicians were being referred to in the days of David, The Danites had already moved up and down that coast, working the same ships. It was like people from southern coastal cities on the Atlantic seaboard being found on the Yankee whaling ships with men from New Bedford. And when Solomon built the temple, the cunning craftsman sent by Hiram to superintend the work of the temple was the son of a man of Tyre. His mother was of the daughters of Dan. Now, how much blood does it take for God to trace a tribe? Joseph was half Egyptian, or Joseph's sons were half Egyptian going out the gate when they were adopted by Israel. What happened to the tribe of Dan? Some people think they were extinct. Well, if they are, God's got to do a new creation during the millennium. Because when Ezekiel describes the reallocation of the land in Palestine during the millennium, heading the list is a territory for Dan. Yet they disappear from the genealogies for the time the book of Chronicles lists those genealogies after their return from Babylon. The Old Testament, having put us in this position, gives us one clue where to look for them, and then leaves it. The Old Testament clue is as follows. Ezekiel 27, 588 B.C., in a prophecy against Tyre. 588 B.C. is after the 10-tribe kingdom, the house of Israel, has been carried into bondage. Now, some people think that the house of Israel and the tribes of Israel, in order to carry out their function, must have an exact number of each member of the tribes. If one baby more is born to one tribe than another one, they got to kill it. It's kind of ludicrous when you think about it, isn't it? God said when he divided the kingdom, he would give Judah one tribe. And then he adds a little prophetic clue. Benjamin. That Benjamin would be a light bearer. Before Judah. In front of Judah. Now, they didn't carry flashlights. And when the tribes formed the nation, they probably forgot that prophecy about a light bearer. But it's rather interesting that when the King of Kings came in his servant Messiah role, the light bearer that took the message in obedience to his command, go first to the lost tribes of Israel, was Saul, who became Paul, a Benjamite. Now, I'm only interested in one thing, proving up God's ability to remember what he says and do it. Now, each of the sons of Jacob, renamed Israel, received promises. Dan received a strange promise. He'll judge his people and be like a serpent by the way. And something in a flash made Jacob exclaim with joy that he has seen the salvation of Israel. Asher got a different promise. The description of prophecy for Simeon and Levi was such that they had to be separated. Get those two together, they become real killers. So when the tribes were divided, God saw to it that Jerusalem and the temple in the territory of Benjamin went with the house of Judah, and the Levites, the servants in the temple, matriculated to Judah. Jeroboam intensified the fulfillment of God's purposes by defrocking the Levites and appointing base men to be priests. So the Levites would then end up with Judah and thus be separated from Simeon. Each tribe got its own prophecy. Now the fundamental promise of the birthright went to the sons of Judah, or rather the sons of Joseph. Out of the birthright came the promise, scepter and lawmaking to Judah. But God in his generosity, as when the promise went to Jacob, God did not fail to give a promise of a kind to Esau. And it sometimes is confused that as Judah, as a nation Judah, became the recipient of the promise given to the tribe of Judah, scepter and lawmaking, all the tribes of Israel that became a part of the kingdom called the House of Israel received the overflow of the promise that was primarily to Ephraim. And that promise was so central to that nation that it became a synonym for the nation to call it Ephraim. And as the other tribes worked in association with Ephraim, central to the house of Israel, because it was of the house of Joseph, Jeroboam, that the kingdom was first born, they shared in the overall blessing given to Ephraim. But each of the separate tribes also had blessings, and Dan happened to be one, very separate. In 588 B.C., after the house of Israel, dominated by Ephraim and Manasseh, was carried into bondage east of Assyria. It says, Judah and the land of Israel, not the people, because they've already been carried into bondage, were thy merchants. They were merchants to Tyre. Dan also and Jabin going to and fro occupied in thy affairs. Now, there are no accidents in God's word. Why do you think he, in this little clue, mentions Dan? Now, in Judges, Dan has already been recognized as not participating with the house of Israel in their battles. They lament the fact, as I said earlier, in the days of Deborah, that Dan abode in ships when there was a war going on and fighting men were needed. Their little territory was too small for them, so early on they went into ships and plied the coast of Palestine in association with Tyre. And the book of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 2, says that when that cunning master builder was sent by Hiram of Tyre to be the cunning craftsman that helped Solomon erect the first temple, his father was of Tyre, his mother of the daughters of Dan. Three places in Daniel, one in Zechariah. Javan is translated Greece. Alexander the Great being distinctly indicated, the word is Javan. Josephus mentions Javan as Greece. So this clue in the Old Testament, plus that clue of the cunning craftsman who built the temple, has Dan in association with the Phoenicians of Tyre and with the Greeks of that peninsula, going to and fro as merchants attending the fairs at Tyre. Now, it is necessary to bear in mind this intimate connection recorded in the Bible of the Phoenicians with Israel, especially with Dan. We must remember the numerical strength of this tribe alone, 62,700 fighting men, neither old men nor boys nor women, shortly after their leaving Egypt. We must consider the schooling they'd had with the then most advanced nation in the world in literature and science. Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And beyond all this, we must remember God's promises concerning Israel. I'm reading from Dan, Pioneer of Israel, nobody's interested in him, by Colonel J.C. Galler. The seed of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob would not be likely to collapse and wither if God's promises are true when in contact with other races. We must bear this in mind, therefore, because we find Grecian, Irish, Scandinavian, and English histories teeming with notices of a certain race called Danai, or Danans, or Danoni, who are synonymously called either Phoenicians or mentioned in company with Phoenicians. And it's safe to say that almost wherever Phoenicians are said to have traded, there we also hear of these Danai, or we find a river or a district stamped with the name of Dan, possibly a continuation of their biblically recorded custom of naming territories where they land or conquer after their father. In a lecture delivered to Jewish working men and their families at the Jews' Infant School on May 23, 1875, the Reverend A.L. Green stated as follows, recorded in the Jewish Chronicle, May 28, 1875. Now, you that have been listening to me teach in the past will also note the importance of the mid-1800s to all these facts about lost tribes beginning to come to the surface of history. The way I wait for you to pay tithe, you can wait on me to light my cigar. A.L. Green stated as follows, quote, "Our forefathers in their happiest times," he's talking to Jews, "in the golden age of the nation's glory, were indeed the public carriers of their day, travelers for commercial enterprise to all the then known countries near and far. The ships of Solomon rivaled the Phoenician navy. The ports of Elath and Zion-Jaber were filled with the ships of Tarshish, which sailed down the Atlantic Gulf of the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean, to Ophir, to Sheba, to Arabia Felix, to India and Ceylon, and through the Pillars of Hercules, Straits of Gibraltar, brought home copper from Cyprus and tin from Spain, possibly from Cornwall also. The Talmud is filled with special regulations bearing on the exceptional wants springing from these various avocations. Synagogues were from earliest times attached to special centers of industry and frequented by special traders, and a workman's ritual was specially arranged to suit the artisan, the landsman, and the seafarer. The pursuits of commerce in its various ramifications were covered by an admirable code of international law. The laws of agency and insurance and hypothecation were codified."
This is the end of side one.